This is a very, very peculiar notion, commercial free speech. Because what it does is it casts corporations, corporate entities, as persons, which they're not. I mean, they're not people. You can't find their graves anywhere, unfortunately.
The First Amendment has been warped so that we understand it now as a way to essentially allow people who own media license to do whatever they want to do with the media that they own, with the property that they buy. The First Amendment becomes a barrier to understanding our responsibilities in a democracy.
Free speech, when you're talking about the media, it's just a fundamentally disproportionate right. My speech is equal to and as free as the speech of AOL Time Warner when they have this platform of access to the world that, you know, I mean, I'm one person.
Somehow, the freedom to inform the general public has become the exclusive right of media corporations.
Giving them free speech rights was a perverse move. And in fact, it was the kind of thing that conservatives, rock-ribbed conservatives, had ruled out as recently as the 40s.
The Telecommunications Act of 1996.
During the Clinton administration in 1996, behind closed doors, the rules of the airwaves were rewritten. In radio, all regulation was literally thrown out. Small independent stations were bought up. Localism disappeared. Companies like Clear Channel went from owning a few stations to owning over 1,100 and dominating whole markets. But something else happened. Under Reagan, in 1987, the Fairness Doctrine was eliminated. Radio and TV stations were no longer required to air opposing viewpoints. This is partially responsible for the rise of right-wing radio. All the time, from coast to coast. The vice chairman of Clear Channel is Tom Hicks. In 1998, Mr. Hicks purchased the Texas Rangers baseball team in a deal that made President Bush a multimillionaire. Clear Channel banned Dixie Chicks songs because the lead singer criticized the president on the run-up to the war.
Tim Robbins, actor and director.
A famous middle-aged rock and roller called me last week to thank me for speaking out against the war, only to go on to tell me that he could not speak himself because he fears repercussions from Clear Channel. They promote our concert appearances, he said. They own most of the stations that play our music. I can't come out against this war.
Why didn't we find out more about that bill before it was passed?
Well, because who's going to report on it, the media?
According to Bill Moyers, during the Senate debate, Senator John McCain said, "You will not see this story on any television or hear it on any radio broadcast." Altogether, the three major network news shows aired a sum total of only 19 minutes of coverage on the Telecommunications Act over the course of 9 months.
Jeff Cohen, founder of FAIR, MSNBC producer.
When a consumer group called the Consumer Federation of America got some money from the long-distance phone companies, who were also, for their own different reasons, opposed to the bill, they tried to buy a 30-second spot on CNN saying that this concentration of power in the hands of a few companies would cause cable TV rates to go through the roof and phone rates to go up, and CNN would not even accept their money. They wouldn't even let a consumer group, a dissenting group, buy their way in to the story.
Each time a new communications technology has emerged, a few companies soon gain total control over it. Will this happen with the internet?
Jeff Chester, Center for Digital Democracy.
Well, up until now, the internet has been governed by a system requiring open access. The telephone network on which the dial-up internet is based has been a common carrier, has been open. So anybody could have a website, anybody could transmit anything, and you could have all kinds of companies competing to provide you with internet service. Open access is being replaced now by a system of closed access.
The reasons that will be offered for controlling the internet: terrorism, spam, pornography, fear of identity theft, convenience, and security. Reasons to think twice about it. An internet where anonymity is outlawed and every penny is accounted for. All transactions can be taxed. All of what you read, see, hear, and communicate is known. By sitting in the alcove, Winston was able to remain outside the range of the telescreen. As far as sight went, he could be heard, of course. George Orwell, 1984.
So companies like AOL, Time Warner, and Comcast, and Paul Allen's Charter, they're opposed to any kind of open access rules. They say, we want to control internet delivery.
Jeff Cohen.
I'll tell you something that I remember in the late 70s, that there were all these people who were like, cable television as panacea. It reminds me a little bit of, oh, the web will solve every problem. We'll have a level playing field where your new website will be able to compete with Disney and Murdoch and Viacom's new website. No.
Michael Powell has ruled that the cable companies are not subject to the open access rules. The future freedom of the internet is in doubt.
You know, one of the myths of our society, you've probably heard this one, is it's based on competition. Have you heard that? That's the sort of pablum they feed us in the bottom fish. The truth of the matter is at the top of the system, the key to the system, is crushing competition. So what we've seen in media, in all the sectors, you've had fewer and fewer companies. The largest companies buy the small companies. They try to get bigger and bigger and make it harder for new companies to enter. Because once you have just a handful of companies dominate an industry, the ability for someone to enter the industry as a newcomer is almost impossible.
I think there are lots of ways that you make news more profitable, and it doesn't mean it doesn't make for better news.
If you ask the reporter, are you interested in truth, of course they'll all say yes. If you go to journalism conferences, which I do quite a bit of, everyone is looking for the truth. The problem is the gatekeepers of truth are not the reporters, they're the owners. And they're the lackey editors who work for the owners. And they'll decide what flies and what works and what pays the freight in terms of the advertising and the numbers. They'll be watching those numbers, and those numbers better be up or they'll get a new anchor.
Joe Kleins, Fox News 10.
The thing that you know that we base our, you know, our coverage, is it a good day or is it a bad day, is the numbers. I mean, I wish we didn't have to rely on that so much. I wish you know there was some way that, you know, you could base, you know, your job or a performance on something other than the numbers. Unfortunately, that's not the climate right now. You look at news directors who get hired, because those are the ones that are really on the chopping blocks. I think their jobs are less secure than Major League Baseball managers.
That's not news. That's marketing. That's something else. I never heard of doing news based on going for some demographic. You do the news. Call me crazy, but that's what you do. You investigate something because it needs to be investigated, or someone's clearly lying, or there's some issue of the public trust that needs to be looked into. You don't do it because you think some demographic will particularly enjoy the story. I mean, that's nutty.
And it's the underlying theme of all the great laments we see, of all the journalists you talk to now. We're so appalled that the public service they entered has become a purely commercial activity.
A pundit is defined as a learned person. According to James Fallows, in his book Breaking the News, pundits are celebrities, telling us what to think of events. Howard Kurtz, the media reporter for CNN, said, quote, "The culture of news has merged with the relentlessly glitzy world of entertainment, producing one great roaring ooze of headlines and hype." Margaret Carlson of Time magazine said producers want people who can sound learned without confusing the matter with too much knowledge. I'm perfect. Jeff Greenfield of CNN said, "We're booked as entertainers. We know what we're being paid for. We are being paid to fill seats. FaceTime on television translates into big-time lecture fees." According to Brian Lamb of C-SPAN, the message from Washington in the last 20 years is that everyone does everything for money. George Will said, "If you pick your audiences carefully, you can give the same speech every time." McLaughlin said, "It's important to go on the road. where you'll get to hear the whole range of views from the Trade Association. These speaking engagements are usually given to business and trade associations and paid for by corporations.
Euphemism, the substitution of an agreeable expression for one that may suggest something unpleasant.
The whole essence now, almost, of selling some sort of regressive policy, like getting rid of Social Security or environmental regulations, is to dress it up in some name that suggests just the opposite. So if you're going to try to get rid of environmental regulations, you call your group Save the Environment. That's the name of the group that's trying to get rid of the regulations.
When Reagan vetoed the Fairness Doctrine, he said it was inconsistent with the tradition of independent journalism.
It's what Orwell would call the politically euphemistic language that is used by everyone, by politicians, but also by news anchors.
We live in an era now where media has become so used to accepting the spin and accepting the structures that they are given that they don't cover news anymore.
Can lies pose as truth? Winston had a friend at the Ministry of Truth named Syme, who was sure that they could. His job was to eliminate words. The aim was to narrow the range of thought by eliminating words that make real thought possible. There would only be good and evil. Everything that Big Brother represented was good. Everything that opposed Big Brother was evil. As Syme explained to Winston, the whole climate of thought will be different. There will be no thought as we understand it now. Orthodoxy means not thinking. One of these days, thought Winston, Syme will be vaporized. He sees too clearly and speaks too plainly. One day he will disappear.
You heard that 175,000 votes were not counted in the state of Florida.
Greg Palast, BBC reporter.
But it's not like everybody's vote counted or was not counted the same. The number of votes not counted was in direct proportion, county to county, to the black population of the county. So how could it be that, for example, in Gadsden County, 52% of the population is black, and 1 out of 8 votes was not counted. 1 out of 8. Whereas in white counties like Citrus, almost all white, only 1 in 200 ballots was voided. How did this happen? And I go down to Florida. I go to Leon County. We're all looking at Chads. You know, the guy's looking at the hang of Chad and all that. They make it sound like it's this big, mysterious deal, checking the ballots in Florida. Most, a big hunk of Florida votes by paper ballot, which is read by a machine. You know, if you ever took like the SAT and used those number 2 pencils, you stick in the machine, you know, they read. It's an optical reader. So they had a practice voting machine set up in a supervisor's office in Tallahassee. And so I voted, took out my pretend ballot, and I voted for Nader, and I voted for Buchanan. And I stuck the Buchanan-Nader ballot into the voting machine. And it came back. I stuck it in again. Came back. I said, okay, wait. I'm trying to vote here, and it won't take my ballot. He said, of course not. You marked it for 2 candidates. You made a mistake. You won't accept a mistake on ballot. I said, what do you mean? All those votes were voided in Gadsden. Now, Leon County's a white county, Tallahassee. Gadsden's right next door to black county. I said, oh, well, see, there's this switch. And in the black counties, like Gadsden, the same exact machines were set to accept ballots with errors. They would accept, you'd make a mistake on your ballot, very easy to do on a paper ballot, like you circle a name instead of check it off. The ballot's accepted, it's voided, your vote doesn't count. And in more of the white areas, it was set on reject so that if you made a mistake and you voted, it came back to you, you were given a fresh ballot, and you got to vote again.
And the losers in this were the American people, whatever your political views, because we all have a right to have the person actually won the election take power. We all have the right to there be a fair count.
Helen Thomas, Dean of the White House Reporters, was quoted as saying that Bush is the worst president she has covered, the worst president ever. At President Bush's pre-war news conference, for the first time in 40 years, Helen Thomas was not allowed to ask a question. She had disappeared.
A chill wind is blowing in this nation. A message is being sent through the White House and its allies in talk radio and Clear Channel and Cooperstown. If you oppose this administration, there can and will be ramifications.
On July 14, 2003, Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife was outed as a CIA operative via a mainstream media leak. He had exposed as false White House uranium claims about Iraq.
In the last several years, media corporations and politics have merged in a new way.
Senator Bernie Sanders.
Murdoch is a brilliant man who, what he has done and has had a tremendous influence in the worst possible way on culture and on media in the United States and throughout the world. And what he does it in England and he does it in the United States. His shtick is appealing to working class people and taking them to the right. And he does this through violence. He does this through super patriotism. He does this through sensationalism. So what you have now, and I'll give him credit for this, Fox Television is the first major network that has no pretense. I mean, CBS and NBC, they have a pretense to objectivity.
Rupert Murdoch's Fox News Network is run by Roger Ailes. Ailes was the executive producer of TV for Richard Nixon. He was a consultant to Ronald Reagan and George Bush I. Tony Snow, a host, was a Bush speechwriter. The anchor, Britt Yoon, contributed articles to the ultra-conservative American Spectator. The phrase fair and balanced is repeated incessantly, like a mantra.
Fair, balanced.
Goebbels said, if you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it.
All of their talk shows are controlled by extreme right-wing Republicans. And it is a front for the right wing of the Republican Party.
John Ellis, the head of Fox's election desk, Jeb and George W. Bush's first cousin. And it's notable that on election night, the first network to declare that George W. Bush had won the presidency of the United States was Fox. And it was John Ellis who made the calculation and the determination that they should make that call.
But it's not only Fox. At GE, the wall between journalism and politics was also broken.
According to the Reuters News Service, former General Electric Chairman Jack Welch came into the NBC studio and insisted that the race be called for fellow Republican George Bush. All the while, an NBC in-house taping system was recording Welch in the studio that night. NBC refused to turn over the tape despite repeated requests from Congressman Henry Waxman. NBC President Andrew Lack claimed turning over the tape would infringe on the editorial process. Waxman replied, Mr. Welch is not a journalist.
And we now know the studies show pretty clearly, they, as they understood, they lost the vote. If there had been a fair vote, they would have been out of power.
Calling the election for George Bush that night set the tone for any recount scenarios.
And the whole tenor of the coverage followed that. If you watch Chris Matthews, O'Reilly, Brian Williams, when is Gore going to finally give up? Another desperation measure by Gore. The assumption being Bush had won. Gore is just scrambling, trying to sneak his way in through some loophole.
The irony is that as the corporate news media has moved to the right, charges of a liberal bias have become pervasive. This impression was created because the Republicans have an arsenal of on-air pundits, adept at polarizing opinion, and ridiculing anyone who disagrees. And they can rely on Murdoch-owned media assets. Some stories disappear. Others are repeated endlessly. Murdoch, in turn, gets his deregulation. A conservative pundit, Bill Salmon, has written a book about Al Gore's attempt to steal the election. I find out that the party launching his beasts and pundits and decide to go videotape them. Funny thing is, these behind-the-scenes operators don't like to be taped.
I'm you're not allowed to film the building without permission.
As the right got more and more of a toehold in the media culture generally through the efforts of Heritage and Hoover Foundation and others, that myth became increasingly serviceable, you see. You could cow moderates, much less liberals. You could cow anyone who wasn't a right-winger working in the media by constantly assailing them with accusations of liberal bias.
Or by assailing them about a lack of patriotism.
I'm Janine Jackson from FAIR, the Media Watch Group. I thought you might like to know that the Heritage Foundation has announced that Jesus would support a war on Iraq.
The argument is no longer made that news media are hard on Republicans and easy on Teddy Kennedy and Ralph Nader. That's not the argument. That argument is so ludicrous as it doesn't even pass the giggle test. The argument now simply redefines left-right entirely in ways that drop out core issues of class, core issues of corporate power.
The media does not discuss the growing inequity between the rich and the poor and the disappearance of the middle class. I could go on and on and on. There is no evidence whatsoever for the claim that there's a liberal bias in the media. It's based entirely on a stereotypic view of the reporters themselves, many of whom may be liberals. Probably they're centrists by now. But the fact is that their own personal views have nothing to do with what gets on TV.
Winston Smith worked at the Ministry of Truth. His job was to alter past news stories so that the version of the truth given by the ruling elite was never contradicted. One of the most troubling things about the media's handling of the 2000 election came a year later. A consortium of major news organizations hired the respected National Opinion Research Council, called NORC, to inspect the 170,000 uncounted votes. NORC was not allowed to characterize its findings. The media companies did that. And the disturbing thing is that they hid the truth by distorting the Florida Supreme Court's actual ruling, which called for the counting of all votes where the intent of the voter was clear. According to the BBC's Greg Palast, who watched the NORC counting operation firsthand, one counter said, quote, "It screamed at you. If someone circled Gore, exactly who do you think they wanted as president?" The consortium did not comment on the exclusion of tens of thousands of clearly marked ballots, which the NORC data reveals. Instead, the consortium came up with a tortured analysis that showed Bush would have retained a lead under one method of counting, just the undervote. On December 24, 2000, on NBC's Meet the Press, the moderator, Tim Russert, said the following: "Florida, Florida, Florida is over. The board is now retired." And that was pretty much the end of the mainstream news media's coverage of the Florida recount and the Supreme Court's decision to stop the counting of votes.
Had Nicaragua had an election like this and the Sandinistas won, the very people that won the Republican election would have insisted that we not only invade Nicaragua, but that all the people who engineered the election be held for war crimes.
They know that they're not there serving at the will of the American people. They know that they stole this election and they created this fraud by keeping African Americans away from the polls. They know this. And they know they have very little time to enact their agenda because they know that they're going to get the crap beat out of them next time. Forget what the media is telling you, okay? This guy ain't going to last, all right? He knows it. They all know it. But if they would do this, if they would stoop this low to steal our White House, what else would they do? What else are they capable of? What else are they capable of? I want to know.
So what we have here is not the sunlight of democracy, but the dark, ominous shadows of totalitarianism, despotism, fascism.
In a curious footnote, over the next 2 years, The Voter News Service, which had called Florida for Al Gore, was to be revamped for the 2002 midterm elections. Suddenly, exit polls had become unreliable. Then, on election night 2002, they weren't used. There were vague statements by the mainstream news media. As it turns out, the major networks own the Voter News Service. My guess is that the Voter News Service got it right on election night when they called Florida for Al Gore. According to congressional testimony, at that time, the Voter News Service projected Gore winning Florida by 7.3%, the equivalent of more than 300,000 votes.
CNN CNBC decision team, quote, "In our many years examining decision screens, we do not believe there has ever been a single instance in which the leader changed in a race in which we had this much data from a survey," close quote.
The Voter News Service was the smoking gun. It had to disappear. Welcome to computer voting, the newest twist in our voting process. With no paper trail. Uncheckable.
Diebold claims its software, the directions that tell the computer how to tabulate votes, is proprietary, a trade secret. Walden O'Dell, Bush pioneer and CEO of Diebold, said on August 14, 2003, "I am committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year," close quote.
Of course, what everybody remembers is Big Brother. That's the cliche from 1984. Let me remind you of another part of the story. The leader realized that he needed the permanent war in order to frighten the people into giving up their rights.
What happens when a group of people have unaccountable media power and can redefine the rules without being questioned? On September 25th, 2002, as the United States moved toward war, relatives of the 9/11 victims spoke. This press conference was not on the evening news.
My brother Jim Pertorti worked on the 95th floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center and lost his life on September 11th. One of the hardest things I had to do was to tell my parents that they would not be seeing their oldest son again. And no one victim of violence or war is less or more important than any other. So my brother, who was seen as a type of collateral damage in some fanatics' eyes, his death is no more or less important than the collateral damage of someone in Iraq or anything. It's a leveling commonality that we have with these people. And so for those people who are making decisions about leading us into this very dangerous error, they have an open invitation. They can come to my house over the holidays. My brother's birthday is right before Christmas. They can see what it's like to be around a family who's affected by war and terrorism. And we believe that this aggressive act, this unilateral act, will only inflame anti-Americanism that is already in the Middle East among Arab communities. It is a factor in leading fanatics to commit crimes against us like September 11th.
And they're saying to America, look, don't use this as a basis to go to war.
Without dissent, you no longer have a democracy. You have a dictatorship. And that's what we're getting from the White House.
Oceania is at war with East Asia. Oceania has always been at war with East Asia. Well, in the novel, of course, Oceania has not always been at war with East Asia. In fact, Oceania and East Asia were allies against Eurasia. But it suits the purposes of the inner party to make everybody think that the latest situation has always been the case. How is that any different from George W. Bush constantly mentioning the horrific fact that Saddam Hussein gassed his own people in 1988 at Halabja? How is it any different when at the time the U.S. actually had foreknowledge that he had chemical weapons, knew that he had gassed his own people, and did not protest? Back then, Saddam Hussein was a darling of the Reagan and Bush administrations.
Charles Lewis.
The thing that is most amazing to me is the lying that goes on today. You are now teaching, I'm not making this up, we are teaching damage control and spin. I remember in this country we used to call spin lying. Now we call it spin and we study it and we admire it, how to put out a line of bull and have it fly for more than 24 hours, and then they high-five each other because they beat the other side if it's another party or it's another candidate or it's another company, if it's one company with another with their annual report or their quarterly earnings or this or that. Public relations has overcome our whole society. It's all PR.
On June 2, 2003, the FCC voted to loosen the ownership rules.
Commissioner Copps.
Good morning. I strongly dissent to this decision because today the Federal Communications Commission empowers America's new media elite with unacceptable levels of influence over the ideas and information upon which our society and our democracy depend.
FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, Democrat.
At issue is whether a few corporations will be ceded enhanced gatekeeper control over the civil dialogue of our country, more content control over our music, entertainment, and information, and veto power over what the majority of our families watch, read, and hear. Radio deregulation gives us powerful and relevant lessons. When Congress and the Commission remove radio concentration protections, we experience massive and largely unforeseen consequences. Diversity of programs suffered. Homogenized music and standardized programming crowded out local and regional talent. Creative local artists found it ever more difficult to obtain playtime. Editorial opinion polarized. Competition in many towns became non-existent as a few companies bought up virtually every station in the market. This experience ought to terrify us as we consider visiting upon television and newspapers what we have inflicted upon radio.
Concerns about the degradation of broadcast content do not justify government manipulation of consumer choice.
FCC Commissioner Kathleen Abernathy, Republican.
Degradation is just an elitist way of saying programming that one does not like.
The decision allows the giant media companies to buy up the remaining local newspaper and exert massive influence over a community by wielding three TV stations, eight radio stations, the cable operator, plus the already monopolistic newspaper. The decision further allows the already massive television networks to buy up even more local TV stations so that they could control up to an unbelievable 80 or 90% of the national television audience. Where are the blessings of localism, diversity, and competition? I see centralization, not localism. I see uniformity, not diversity. I see monopoly and oligopoly, not competition.
It would be anathema to the First Amendment to regulate media ownership in an effort to steer consumers towards other programming.
90% of the top cable channels are owned by the same giants that own the TV networks and the cable systems. More channels are great, but when they're all owned by the same people, cable doesn't advance localism, editorial diversity, and competition. And those who believe the Internet alone will save us from this fate should realize that the dominating Internet news sources are controlled by the same media giants who control radio, TV, newspapers, and cable.
I refuse to pour 1 ounce of cement to support a structure that dictates to the American people what they should watch, listen to, or think.
The public reaction against the proposed changes has been unlike anything the FCC has ever seen. Of the nearly 750,000 comments we have received, nearly all oppose increased media consolidation, over 99.9%.
Those commissioners voting in favor of the item signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed signify.
The item is adopted. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
But it turned out not to be over. There was an unprecedented bipartisan uprising in the Senate.
The list of well-recognized people and organizations who oppose all or part of the FCC's media ownership rules is one of the strangest lists of strange bedfellows you'll ever hear.
Senator Thomas Daschle, Democrat, South Dakota.
Opponents include Walter Cronkite, William Sapphire, the National Rifle Association, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the National Organization for Women, Senator Jesse Helms.
Theoretically, deregulation is good, but it's not always the right way to go.
in the shadow of the largest corporate scandals in the history of this country, the last thing we need is to have regulators with no teeth.
Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat, North Dakota.
I believe it appears to me so evident that the big interests were served here at the expense of the public interest. Would you not agree with me that today those who most aggressively celebrate your decision are the biggest economic interests in broadcasting in this country? Are they not the ones that are celebrating your decision?
I have no idea who's celebrating our decision.
You really don't? Are you kidding me? You say they're modest changes. Clearly they're not modest changes. When in nearly 200 cities, newspapers will be able to buy the television station. You say that it'll promote more competition. Nonsense. The evidence suggests that is simply not the case. You say that there'll be few mergers and acquisitions. Of course, that stands logic on its head. And you say the court made us do it. The court didn't make you do it. I mean, this is the old joke in the movie, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? Commissioner Abernathy, you said that we were acting out of irrational fear instead of hard facts with respect to the issue of consolidation. Is there any evidence that you see with respect to consolidation, particularly with respect to radio in recent years, and also television, that would suggest we have an irrational fear of consolidation?
What you have to balance here is you have to balance the First Amendment rights of the licensees against the rights of all the public to have diversity, localism, and competition.
On September 16, 2003, by a vote of 55 to 40, the Senate repealed all of the FCC's new rules. The fight continues.
The founders did not anticipate the protections for commercial speech that we now have.
Mark Lloyd, former NBC reporter.
And nor did they anticipate essentially the warp to the sense of the First Amendment that has occurred really since the 1970s.
Professor Mark Crispin Miller.
We have to revisit the terms. What did they mean? What were they talking about? They can't possibly have meant that there should be free speech rights for transnational corporations, because there weren't any back in the 18th century. They didn't exist. They weren't thinking of that. They were thinking of the citizens of the democracy.
Citizens have First Amendment rights to a diversity of antagonistic views.
Media reform is something that is absolutely crucial. It is the primary issue. It is the most important thing. Nothing is more important, because if we don't have a media system that we can use to get our word out, whatever our word may be, if there is not a viable democratic media system for getting that word out, forget it. You know, we're screwed. We're completely screwed. We need antitrust activity, okay? And that's a complicated thing, and it will require that we rethink the very basis of antitrust law, which at the moment is all economistic. We have to understand that the real reasons why we particularly need to look at antitrust in the realm of media industries is not for business reasons, not for economic reasons primarily, but because the content, the crucial content of the news is completely distorted by large commercial interests.
Epilogue. Michael Powell resigned as chairman of the FCC. GENBC has purchased Vivendi Universal. Rupert Murdoch now owns Direct Satellite TV. He and his third wife, Chinese-born Wendy Deng, have two young children and are building a home outside Beijing.
Some reporters have compared George W. Bush to Ronald Reagan. I reflected back on the Post interview from 1980 and about the hostages. How often do major news stories get buried down the public memory hole while a lie is turned into truth?
There's a window of opportunity now. Most governments, most countries have not figured out how to limit access to them, to the Internet, and they've not figured out, and powerful companies have not figured out how to block information that is inconvenient or unfriendly to them or that they don't like off of the Internet, at least in this brief window that we have before they all figure it out.
Will history repeat itself? Will the public find out about the threat to the Internet before it's too late?
We're not in the clear here at all. I mean, this is not a straight shot here where we can just go ahead and do whatever we want. It's complicated. But it's new, and there are some things we don't know about it, and no one else knows about it. And as long as there is the slightest bit of vagueness or the unknown element is something I'm going to exploit as much as possible.
To date, the networks refuse to release the raw exit poll data. Something is definitely wrong. We're talking about the free world here. John Zogby, pollster. You've been listening to a radio adaptation of the film Orwell Rolls in His Grave, written and directed by Robert Kane Pappas, released in 2006. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. I want to conclude the program by reading you from an astonishing article I came across quite by accident on the internet that demonstrates how corporations use the PR industry to manufacture ideas of value and even create phony cultural traditions. The article was published in 1982 in the Atlantic Monthly, written by Edward J. Epstein, and titled, "Have You Ever Tried to Sell a Diamond?" He writes, "The diamond invention, the creation of the idea that diamonds are rare and valuable and are essential signs of esteem, is a relatively recent development in the history of the diamond trade. Until the late 19th century, diamonds were found only in a few riverbeds in India and in the jungles of Brazil, and the entire world production of gem diamonds amounted to a few pounds a year. In 1870, however, huge diamond mines were discovered near the Orange River in South Africa, where diamonds were soon being scooped out by the ton. Suddenly, the market was deluged with diamonds. The British financiers who had organized the South African mines quickly realized that their investment was endangered. Diamonds had little intrinsic value, and their price depended almost entirely on their scarcity. The financiers feared that when the new mines were developed in South Africa, diamonds would become at best only semi-precious gems. The major investors in the diamond mines realized that they had no alternative but to merge their interests into a single entity that would be powerful enough to control production and perpetuate the illusion of scarcity of diamonds. The instrument they created in 1888 was called De Beers Consolidated Mines Limited, incorporated in South Africa. De Beers proved to be the most successful cartel arrangement in the annals of modern commerce. While other commodities, such as gold, silver, copper, rubber, and grains, fluctuated wildly in response to economic conditions, diamonds have continued, with few exceptions, to advance upward in price every year since the Depression. The diamond invention is far more than a monopoly for fixing diamond prices. It is a mechanism for converting tiny crystals of carbon into universally recognized tokens of wealth, power, and romance. Both women and men had to be made to perceive diamonds not as marketable precious stones, but as an inseparable part of courtship and married life. The illusion had to be created that diamonds were forever, forever, in the sense that they should never be resold. In September of 1938, Harry Oppenheimer, son of the founder of De Beers and then 29, traveled from Johannesburg to New York City to meet with Gerald M. Lauck, president of N.W. Ayer, a leading advertising agency in the United States. Lauck and N.W. Ayer had been recommended to Oppenheimer by the Morgan Bank, which had helped his father consolidate De Beers' financial empire. His bankers were concerned about the price of diamonds, which had declined worldwide. In Europe, where diamond prices had collapsed during the Depression, there seemed little possibility of restoring public confidence in diamonds. Furthermore, Europe was on the verge of war, and there seemed little possibility of expanding diamond sales. This left the United States as the only real market for De Beers' diamonds. Oppenheimer and the bankers believed that an advertising campaign could persuade Americans to buy more expensive diamonds. Oppenheimer suggested to Lauck that his agency prepare a plan for creating a new image for diamonds among Americans. In their subsequent investigation of the American diamond market, the staff of N.W. Ayer found that since the end of World War I in 1919, the total amount of diamonds sold in America, measured in carats, had declined by 50%. An Ayer memo concluded that the depressed state of the market for diamonds was, quote, the result of the economy, changes in social attitudes, and the promotion of competitive luxuries, close quote. Specifically, the Ayer study stressed the need to strengthen the association in the public's mind of diamonds with romance. Since, quote, young men buy over 90% of all engagement rings, it would be crucial to inculcate in them the idea that diamonds were a gift of love. The larger and finer the diamond, the greater the expression of love. Similarly, young women had to be encouraged to view diamonds as an integral part of any romantic courtship. Since the Ayer plan to romanticize diamonds required subtly altering the public's picture of the way a man courts and wins a woman, the advertising agency strongly suggested exploiting the relatively new medium of motion pictures. Movie idols, the paragons of romance for the mass audience, would be given diamonds to use as their symbols of indestructible love. In addition, the agency suggested offering stories and society photographs to selected magazines and newspapers, which would reinforce the link between diamonds and romance. Fashion designers would talk on radio programs about the trend towards diamonds that Ayer planned to start. The Ayer plan also envisioned using the British royal family to help foster the romantic allure of diamonds. An Ayer memo said, quote, since Great Britain has such an important interest in the diamond industry, the royal couple could be of tremendous assistance to this British industry by wearing diamonds rather than other jewels, close quote. Queen Elizabeth later went on a well-publicized trip to several South African diamond mines, and she accepted a diamond from Oppenheimer. In addition to putting these plans into action, N.W. Ayer placed a series of lush four-color advertisements in magazines that were presumed to mold elite opinion, featuring reproductions of famous paintings by artists such as Picasso, Durin, Dali, and Dufy. The advertisements were intended to convey the idea that diamonds, like paintings, were unique works of art. By 1941, the advertising agency reported to its client that it had already achieved impressive results in its campaign. The sale of diamonds had increased by 55% in the United States since 1938. N.W. Ayer noted also that its campaign had required, quote, the conception of a new form of advertising which has been widely imitated ever since. There was no direct sale to be made. There was no brand name to be impressed on the public mind. There was simply an idea, the eternal emotional value surrounding the diamond. And a new color, diamond blue, was created and used in these campaigns, close quote. In its 1947 strategy plan, the advertising agency strongly emphasized a psychological approach. Quote, we are dealing with a problem in mass psychology. We seek to strengthen the tradition of the diamond engagement ring to make it a psychological necessity capable of competing successfully at the retail level with utility goods and services, close quote. It defined as its target audience some 70 million people, 15 years and over, whose opinion we hope to influence in support of our objectives. NWA outlined a subtle program that included arranging for lecturers to visit high schools across the country. Quote, all of these lectures revolve around the diamond engagement ring and are reaching thousands of girls in their assemblies, classes, and informational meetings in our leading educational institutions. The agency had organized in 1946 a weekly service called Hollywood Personalities, which provided 125 leading newspapers with descriptions of the diamonds worn by movie stars. In 1947, the agency commissioned a series of portraits of engaged socialites. The idea was to create prestigious role models for the poorer middle-class wage earners. We spread the word of diamonds worn by stars of screen and stage, by wives and daughters of political leaders, by any woman who can make the grocer's wife and the mechanic's sweetheart say, I wish I had what she has, close quote. An NWA-er copywriter came up with a caption, a diamond is forever, which was scrawled on the bottom of a picture of two young lovers on a honeymoon. Even though diamonds can in fact be shattered, chipped, discolored, or incinerated to ash, the concept of eternity perfectly captured the magical qualities that the advertising agency wanted to attribute to diamonds. Within a year, a diamond is forever became the official motto of De Beers. In 1951, NWA found some resistance to its million-dollar publicity blitz. It noted in its annual strategy review, quote, the millions of brides and brides-to-be are subjected to at least two important pressures that work against the diamond engagement ring. Among the more prosperous, there is the sophisticated urge to be different as a means of being smart. The lower-income groups would like to show more for the money than they can find in the diamond they can afford, close quote. To remedy these problems, the advertising agency argued, quote, it is essential that these pressures be met by the constant publicity to show that only the diamond is everywhere accepted and recognized as a symbol of betrothal, close quote. NWA was always searching for new ways to influence American public opinion. Not only did it organize a service to, quote, release to the women's pages the engagement ring, but it set about exploiting the relatively new medium of television by arranging for actresses and other celebrities to wear diamonds when they appeared before the camera. It also established a diamond information center that placed a stamp of quasi-authority on the flood of, quote, historical data and, quote, news it released. NWA commented in a memorandum to De Beers, because we have done it successfully, we have opportunities to help with articles originated by others, close quote. NWA proposed to apply to the diamond market Thorsten Veblen's idea, stated in The Theory of the Leisure Class, that Americans were motivated in their purchases not by utility but by conspicuous consumption. Quote, the substantial diamond gift can be made a more widely sought symbol of personal and family success, an expression of socioeconomic achievement, close quote, N.W. Ayers said in a report. To exploit this desire for conspicuous display, the agency specifically recommended, quote, promote the diamond as one material object which can reflect, in a very personal way, a man's success in life. Close quote. Since this campaign would be addressed to upwardly mobile men, the advertisements ideally, quote, should have the aroma of tweed, old leather, and polished wood, which is characteristic of a good club, close quote. Toward the end of the 1950s, NWA reported to De Beers that 20 years of advertisements and publicity had had a pronounced effect on the American psyche. Quote, "Since 1939, an entirely new generation of young people has grown to marriageable age. To this new generation, a diamond ring is considered a necessity to engagements by virtually everyone." Close quote. In America, which remained the most important market for most of De Beers' diamonds, NW Ayers recognized the need to create a new demand for diamonds among long married couples. Candies come, flowers come, furs come, but such ephemeral gifts fail to satisfy a woman's psychological craving for a renewal of the romance, N.W. Ayers said in a report. An advertising campaign could instill the idea that the gift of a second diamond in the later years of marriage would be accepted as a sign of ever-growing love. The diamond market had to be further restructured in the mid-1960s to accommodate a surfeit of minute diamonds, which De Beers undertook to market for the Soviets. They had discovered diamond mines in Siberia after intensive exploration in the 1950s. De Beers and its allies no longer controlled the diamond supply and realized that open competition with the Soviets would inevitably lead, as Harry Oppenheimer gingerly put it, to price fluctuations, which would weaken the carefully cultivated confidence of the public in the value of diamonds. Oppenheimer, assuming that neither party could afford risking the destruction of the diamond invention, offered the Soviets a straightforward deal, a single channel for controlling the world supply of diamonds. In accepting this arrangement, the Soviets became partners in the cartel and co-protectors of the diamond invention. Almost all of the Soviet diamonds were under half a carat in their uncut form, and there was no ready retail outlet for millions of such tiny diamonds. When it made its secret deal with the Soviet Union, De Beers had expected production from Siberian mines to decrease gradually. Instead, production accelerated at an incredible pace, and De Beers was forced to reconsider its sales strategy. De Beers ordered N.W. Ayers to reverse one of its themes. Women were no longer to be led to equate the status and emotional commitment to an engagement ring with the sheer size of the diamond. A strategy for small diamond sales was outlined, stressing the importance of quality, cut, and color over size. Pictures of 1/4-carat rings would replace pictures of up to 2-carat rings. The news release also made clear that women should think of diamonds, regardless of size, as objects of perfection. A small diamond could be just as perfect as a large diamond. De Beers devised the Eternity Ring, made up of as many as 25 tiny Soviet diamonds, which could be sold to an entirely new market of older married women. The advertising campaign was based on the theme of recaptured love. Again, sentiments were born out of necessity. Older American women received a ring of miniature diamonds because of the needs of a South African corporation to accommodate the Soviet Union. And I've been reading from an article, "Have You Ever Tried to Sell a Diamond?" published in the 1982 Atlantic Monthly, written by Edward J. Epstein. So there you have it. How a cartel and an advertising agency used the media to create a phony cultural tradition in the interest of profit. Thank you for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests.